The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we have a lot to share. My guest, continuing with our series of conversations with remarkable minds, but abbreviated because of his tight schedule, is Professor George Lakoff. He is one of the most recognized cognitive linguists in the United States. He's a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and one of the founders of some of the more progressive think tanks in the United States, including the Santa Fe Institute and the Rockridge Institute. We're going to talk about the failure of the left and progressives in framing language and ideas and success of the right in doing so. So what lessons can progressives take from the right? That'll be our guest. Also today, a short commentary by Richard Gower, exec producer, and myself, offering a diplomatic challenge to Op-Ed News. Op-Ed News, which has been a really good forum for many progressive articles, has now said no to any articles on vaccines, autism, and disease prevention. They have opted out, believing in the Anderson Cooper model that don't look for the truth. Well, we'll give you a counterpoint, an intelligent counterpoint. Later today, since for some stations which are nonprofit, and I am helping raise funds, I'll be on for a total of 3 hours on those stations, but many of you will not be able to hear it. I'll be talking about a response to the FDA and CDC. They're saying a major scientific review found that the silver mercury fillings in your mouth are safe. All right? The mainstream media said we concur. We don't. We will completely deconstruct each one of their points and show you that they're wrong, even using the same science they relied upon. And this just shows you the politics of science. Also, the latest on the environment and how the fluoride in the water and then a toothpaste is causing bone cancer. And then a special challenge to Bill Gates. Bill Gates is arguably one of the most influential, powerful elites in the world. But I believe, even if it's his best intent to help those in the world, he is wrong. He is suggesting depopulation through contraceptive vaccines. Doubt me? We'll play you the sound clip. Plus, the Gates Foundation controls the media through massive journalism grants from Ethan Huff. So we'll give you the skinny on why we believe that Bill Gates should have a sit-down at some point, if he chooses, with those of us who could share a different point of view. Then what he does with that is up to him. So we're going to call out Bill Gates today in a diplomatic and polite way and ask him, would he at least consider that there's a different way of helping the poor and hungry and diseased in Africa and other places in the world, except for very powerful cancer-causing, immune-suppressing pharmaceutical drugs that he's funding and advocating. As you see, we have a lot to share. Let us begin. And updates on some of the shows. For example, many of you in the New York area, the Los Angeles area, have only been listening on non-commercial radio in the last 3 months or so because we're expanding our program. It's being picked up all over the United States. I just want to remind people that on this program over the past 3 years, we accurately and very specifically predicted all five bubbles: the subprime bubble, the commercial real estate bubble, the credit card bubble, the hedge fund bubble, and the equity buyout bubble. We have not seen the implosion or collapse of all those bubbles. We will. We also predicted accurately before anyone else that there would be economic turmoil that would be based upon loss of jobs, loss of social services, high prices of food, and massive unemployment and poverty. And we predicted Greece, Portugal, Ireland, England, France, and Italy. We also predicted that the Middle East, all 22 of the Arab League nations, would be in revolt. This was 2 years ago. Now, what's our next prediction? What do we see happening? And will the revolt come to America? And if it does, unlike everywhere else in the world, where it's been peaceful, nonviolent, at least from the protesters' point of view, what's the likelihood that 80 million armed and angry, under or unemployed Americans are going to act the same way as those in other countries? Gerald Salante, the number one predictor of economic and social events in America, will be on my show this coming Tuesday for an in-depth one-hour discussion, and we will go into great depth about the anti-government movements around the world and what's going to be happening here at home. And if you think Wisconsin is an indication, I believe you got it wrong. I don't believe Wisconsin represents anything compared to what we're going to see, and for different reasons. But you'll want to stay tuned for that. Let's now go to the latest on health and healing. We like to start by giving positive information that makes a difference. First up, mechanisms revealed for antioxidants' cancer benefits. As always, all of our information comes from independent peer-reviewed journals. This is Cancer Biology and Therapy, research done at Thomas Jefferson University. Here's what it says. They found how the antioxidants reduce the impact of cancer, and which antioxidants do so, like vitamin C and beta-carotene, and vitamin E and N-acetylcysteine, and chlorophylls. They're very big on the chlorophylls because that's, they believe, an underutilized segment. And they believe that they inhibit the way that cancer cells are fed, and they can stop the cancer cells that are defective from getting worse. So finally, they've come up with not just that they do work, that we've known for a long time. Every one of the study, the nurses study, the Harvard physician study, have all shown that if you're eating more fruits and vegetables, if you're leaning towards a Mediterranean diet, if you're exercising, not smoking, you will have a substantially longer life. And according to the Loma Linda University study, and there have been over 300 studies from Loma Linda University Medical School in California, and studying the Seventh-day Adventist, that if you're vegetarian and you don't smoke and drink, you could live at least 12 years longer in good health than the average person. So now we know the mechanisms at the cellular level. And I've discussed this before, but in real simple lay language. You have chromosomes that are capped off with what are called telomeres. And these take a while in order for them to shorten or to wear out. The more you do that creates oxidative stress, smoking, drinking, air pollutants, working around paint and paint thinners, copy machine gases. If you work in tool and die companies, if you work in a shipyard, where you're breathing in pollutants, if you live in a major city like Los Angeles, you're going to be breathing into particulate matter. Now, if you lived in Shanghai, and I was just driven recently by a professor from KPFK, our sister station, to a lecture I was doing, he said that the week before, his daughter is a student in Shanghai, and said that as she was walking down the street, as she held her hand in front of her, clear out her arm stretch, she could not see her fingers on her hand. I said, That's under 24 inches of visibility. He said, that is correct. Traffic was at a standstill. And you breathe it in, and it costs them a lot of lives over there, just the air pollution. Now, that also causes oxidative stress. Hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, when they're cooked, when carbohydrates are cooked, like a piece of toast, or let's say a bun, a bagel, a muffin. The cooking of carbohydrates creates a biochemical product called acrylamide. It's carcinogenic. Cooking of meats, any meat, when you cook it, you create a byproduct in the meat called heterocyclic amines. Now, the more you cook it, like grilling and barbecuing, deep frying, the more of these heterocyclic amines you create. Now, here's what's interesting. When you bread something like fried chicken or fried fish or fried shrimp, you're combining the worst, carbohydrate cooking and animal protein cooking. Those two together create a byproduct called glycation. This glycation means that your cells then are adversely affected, and you start to speed up the lifespan of the telomeres, which then adversely affects the chromosomes, which then affects the genes, which means you literally age yourself prematurely. Now, all the scientific models for aging show that we should be able to live 150 years in ideal health. Why are we only living to 75 in poor health? Because of how much pro-inflammation we create. Therefore, the more antioxidants, a fresh glass of apple juice, more fruits and vegetables, berries in the morning, raspberries, strawberries, blueberries, some cherries in season, strawberries, more green leafy vegetables, not iceberg lettuce, but really greens, you know, like arugula and some stir-fried collard greens or kale. The more of that you have in whole grains and beans, black beans, navy beans, soybeans, dookie beans, fava beans, kidney beans, black-eyed peas, there's over 90 beans that are commonly available in the United States. More so in India, for example, over 200. The more these you have, the more fibers you have, the more essential fatty acids you have, the more the DHA fat you have, the more inflammation you turn off. The good fats turn off inflammation. Coconut oil, good old coconut oil, turns off inflammation. Olive oil, cold-pressed organic olive oil, turns off inflammation. Flaxseed oil turns off inflammation. All of the olives that you eat turn off inflammation. The polyphenols in chocolate turn off inflammation. Green tea turns off inflammation. Turmeric, the spice with curcumin, turns off inflammation. So the more these anti-inflammatory, antioxidant-rich foods, the more protection your cells have, the more free radicals you trap and neutralize, the longer the telomeres stay intact. And that's why one person lives a long life and another person lives a shorter life. And by the way, what is one of the biggest factors to age you prematurely? Distress. The more stress you're under, the more hormones that are stress-related, like cortisol, epinephrine, norepinephrine, catecholamines, adrenaline, that you secrete. And where normally these are flight-or-fight responses that should take place no more than about a minute and a half to 2 minutes, you can have those on 24/7 if you're under stress, depression, anger, anxiety all the time, insecurity, then just turns that switch on, a 5-alarm fire in your body. That's why stressed people are more susceptible to metabolic syndrome, heart attack, stroke, and cancers. So now they figured out how antioxidants in your food protect you. And that's good news, because we all want to live longer and healthier lives. Later today, I'll be talking about the latest in anti-aging medicine, including how garlic can counteract key elements of cancer, how vitamin K can slash cancer, how pomegranates can help prevent cancer, and as always, these are from independent peer-reviewed journals. Pistachios can reduce lung cancer, omega-3s can reduce colon cancer, green tea can modify lung cancer, and broccoli extract can reduce skin cancer. How about that? That's all coming to you later. Let's go to our guest who is standing by and say hello once again to his bio, Professor George Lakoff. He is a cognitive linguist, and he's been teaching at the University of California, Berkeley since 1972. In addition to being a leading voice in the embodied mind, standing in the company of other researchers and philosophers such as David Boehm, he has been applying the science of cognition and metaphor to shed light on political language and policies, the process which politicians view, right, center, and left, are taking shape. He is the author of The Political Mind. Nice to have you with us today.
My pleasure.
Now, we'd like for you to share your thoughts, if you would please, on why it is, and this is just a brief overview, people like myself, and I do not call myself a liberal or a conservative, Republican or Democrat, I would consider myself a progressive, humanistic, spiritual self-actualizer. Hence, I look for the truth in everything. I believe that there are progressives in the conservative ideologies, and I believe they're progressive in the liberal ideologies, but I believe that the language of being able to bring people together, the independents, the constitutionalists, the greens, the more humanistic libertarians, bringing these people together has been like asking 1,000 cats to march down the street. And as a result, a relatively small number of people on the right have been much better organized, much more disciplined, and they end up dominating the day, our body politic, deconstructing our safety nets and government, and in effect allowing Wall Street, the military-industrial complex, the big oil and gas and coal and nuclear energies to get subsidies, yet they're taking away the rights of many people to fair bargaining. And you think, well, how in the world is such a small percentage of the voting population, 19 to 20%, and the largest segment, 42%, are independents? Why is it the independents are not making a greater difference? Could you share your insight on this failure of the left and progressives in framing language and ideas that would have as much success in uniting people as the Republicans do in their efforts?
Well, there are 5 books I've written on the subject. The most recent is The Political Mind. And so it's not a short answer, but it's an interesting and important answer.
Take your time. I'm not going to interrupt you. I like my guests to take all the time they need to answer.
Okay. Well, let's begin with the way the brain works a little bit. First, I have a book called Don't Think of an Elephant, which requires that, of course, you're going to think of an elephant. That is, when you negate something, you activate what you the part of the brain that you're negating. So you can't just deny something and really argue against it. And what you find is that Democrats are doing this constantly. The reason for that is that every word activates a circuit in your brain called a frame circuit, and every word is defined with respect to such a frame circuit. And the organization of ideas in the brain, remember, every idea you have is physically there in your brain, in brain circuitry. There's no such thing as ideas just floating in air. I mean, they're physical things. They're organized. And they're organized so that that political ideas are subservient to moral ideas. What that means is all politics is moral. Every political leader gets up and says, do what I propose because it's right. Nobody gets up and says, do what I propose because it's wrong or that it doesn't matter. You know, that is, there's always a moral ideology or a moral set of principles behind any proposal that any political leader is giving. And we have different moral systems. The conservative and progressive moral systems are very, very different. And when I studied their structure, what I found was something interesting. I asked a question. The question was, why do conservatives believe the bunch of things they believe? Why are the same people who are against abortion, for owning guns? Why are the people who are for owning guns against environmental regulations? Why are the people against environmental regulations for tort reform and so on? I found myself against all of those things, having the opposite views. And then I ask myself, why is it that I have my views, those collections of views? And what I found when I started looking at it as a cognitive scientist is that there were moral theories that held those views together, and there were metaphorical moral theories. That is, we think metaphorically all the time. That is, metaphor is not just in language, it's in thought. And the basic moral systems behind conservative and progressive thought are family-based moral systems. They're based on strict father families and what I'll call nurturing parent families. And that these family-based moral systems are projected onto other systems, such as the, churches, any kind of governing system at all, the market and the nation. And so we have a nation as family metaphor, in which we have founding fathers. We send our sons and daughters to war and so on. And this understanding, which is largely unconscious, remember 98% of our thought is unconscious, that understanding structures conservative and progressive reasoning about politics. Now, what's interesting about this is that most people have both moral systems at once. Now, how can you have two conflicting moral systems in the same brain? The answer is a basic structural feature of brains called inhibition. That is, there are circuits that cannot both be active at once, and when one is active, it inhibits or turns off the other. And that's what happens in what I call biconceptuals. People who call themselves moderates or independents are actually not neutral. They have some progressive views and some conservative views. And they're usually about different things. You can be progressive about social issues and conservative about financial issues, or progressive about financial issues and conservative about foreign policy, and so on. All kinds of possible combinations of that exist. What's interesting in our electoral system is that about 15 to 20% of the electorate is biconceptual. That is, they are partially conservative and partially progressive. And the way that elections go is that if you can get enough of these biconceptuals voting for you and you can get your people out to vote, then you win elections. And it, you have to get, say 8 to 10% or more of voting for you of those folks, and you win. Notice that in elections, let's say in the 2008 presidential election, Obama won 53 to 47% of the votes. Had 4% of those votes shifted, McCain would have gotten more votes. Not necessarily more electoral votes, but he would have gotten more votes. And that's how close these things are. And so the strategies are to shift those biconceptuals, to move them over. Now, why is it that conservatives are doing better at all of these with a small number of people supporting their views than progressives and liberals are? Why is that happening? There's a deep reason, and it has to do with two factors. The first is the communication system. Conservatives have built since the early 1970s a remarkable communication system. They not only have about 80 think tanks, but they also have professionals doing the framing of language and ideas for them that have been carried out for over 30 to 40 years. And they have training institutes that train tens of thousands of conservatives every year to think and talk conservative. In addition to that, they keep track of those folks, and they book them on, they have booking agencies booking them on radio and TV and in all sorts of local venues, in schools, churches, or local organizations, and so on. So conservatives have a consistent message that goes out all the time, every day, all over the country. And what does that mean? It means that their language is going to activate their ideas and their moral system, thus strengthening it in people who are biconceptual, that is, people who have some of both ideas. That is an extremely important fact. Now, the question is, why is it that they have such a system and the Democrats and progressives and liberals do not? And that is something deep and important. What cognitive science and neuroscience has discovered is that we don't think in terms of traditional logic. We don't think in terms of what is called the rational actor model or enlightenment reason. It is not the case that if you just tell people the facts, they'll reason to the right conclusion. Rather, we think in terms of structures called frames. We think in terms of metaphors. We think in terms of narratives that have emotional content, strong emotional content. We think in terms of imagery and so on. Now, in the academic world, this is taught in the cognitive and brain sciences, and the people who pay most attention to the cognitive and brain sciences are the people in the business schools who teach marketing, because marketing depends upon how people really think. Conservatives who have gone to business schools have studied marketing, and they understand how people really think. Not necessarily the people who are actually running for office or in office, but rather the people who run the communication systems for conservatives. When progressives go to college and liberals go to college, if they want to go into politics, they'll study political science, economics, law, and public policy. In those fields, they don't teach the cognitive and brain sciences at all. They teach traditional logic and what is called the rational actor model, a traditional view of rationality that assumes that everybody thinks logically, and if you just tell people the truth, they'll reason to the right conclusion. That doesn't mean truth is irrelevant, but it does mean something important. They also teach that thought is conscious, which it is not. 98% is unconscious. So what you have is a situation where people who are the policymakers in the Democratic Party and the, most of the people who are liberals who are elected to office think that people think differently than they really do. And they have a different view of what language is. They assume language is secondary to policy, whereas conservatives understand that language affects thought and morality. The result is a totally different attitude toward messaging and toward getting your ideas across and toward understanding what your ideas are. So for progressives, what they're going to do is give you long lists of policies. For conservatives, they're going to give you moral principles. For example, take health care. Frank Luntz wrote a memo about how to defeat health care. He says you defeat it on moral grounds. That is, and it's very simple, he says, we take two moral principles, freedom and life, and you talk about government takeover, which is about freedom. You talk about death panels, which is about life. And that's what conservatives did. They repeated that over and over. Repetition is extremely important, but repetition that evokes moral principles. What did the Obama administration do? Exactly the opposite. They took polls, and their polls showed that people liked the details of the policies. You know, they liked the idea that their kids could stay on their policies when they went to college. They liked the idea of not having preconditions and so on. And they made a list of all the nice parts of their bill that people liked. And then they went out and said, we're just going to tell you the truth about policy. There are 24 different good things about this. Here they are, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 24. And, David Axelrod got on Organizing for America and said, you have to tell everybody about these wonderful 24 principles. And if you can't remember them, just remember there are three groups of eight. And nobody, of course, is going to ever remember the three groups of eight. This is very important. The communication on both sides is very different. And the conservatives understand that you'd have to talk in terms of your moral principles. And they do. And they understand their moral principles very well. Now, what is going on now is very important. Let's take the Wisconsin protests. What's going on in Wisconsin is quite remarkable. It is the first time in a long time that progressives have stood up to a conservative onslaught. But the issue there, which is reported in the media, is supposed to be just about budgets and unions. And the conservatives understand very well that this is not just about budgets and unions at all. What conservatives want, really, is not just to balance a budget or to, do certain cuts and so on. What they want is to have the country run according to a conservative worldview. It's a worldview in which there's only individual responsibility, in which it's not just anti-government, because they like government that does certain things for them. They like government that has a strong military. They're not trying to cut a military budget, for example. They like government that hands public resources over to private companies. That sounds pretty good to them. So that the bill in Wisconsin that the Governor Wallace is putting forth there is a bill that it allows the governor to sell off state-owned resources in, for heating, cooling, or energy to any company without competitive bids at what he considers a reasonable price for the state. That is, the governor can privatize anything at all with any company he likes without competitive bids. What this means is he can sell off the resources of the people of Wisconsin and privatize them to people who will support conservative ideas. This is not about breaking unions. The issue of breaking the unions, not merely about breaking the unions. If you break the public employees' unions, what you'll be doing is breaking the major source of funding for Democratic candidates all over the country. Every place in America, the major source of funding for Democrats and for liberals is those unions. If those unions are broken, then you have an open field for conservatives. It'll only be large conservative corporations that will be funding candidates in elections all over America, and what you will get is a radical conservative takeover of the entire country in every issue. And this isn't just economics. It has to do with issues like gay rights. It has to do with women's rights, immigrant rights, not just collective bargaining rights, but healthcare, you name it, education. They want to get rid of public education, and privatize that too. What that means would be a disaster for every part, every sector of America. So what they're doing is saying, oh, we're using the budget as an excuse for doing that. And in fact, in Wisconsin, the reason that you have a budget deficit is because they cut taxes for the wealthy just before they declared a budget deficit. If they hadn't done that, there would have been no deficit. So this is a rather remarkable thing. The reporting on this is, even reporting from Democrats and from liberals and progressives, is that this is an issue of collective bargaining, versus the right-wing view of economics and budget cutting. It's not about budget cutting. And there are honest conservatives who've come out and said that. Karl Rove got on Fox News, as did Shep Smith, one of the conservative commentators, and they said, look, this is not about budgets at all. This is about who's going to run the country, period. Because if, they destroy the unions, then conservatives get to run the country. That's what this is really about. Now, that is not reported very much. It's just not there. It's reported today in the New York Times in an op-ed piece by Paul Krugman, but it's not reported on the front pages. And it's not reported generally on TV and generally in the blogs or anything like that. You have Anderson Cooper saying that the protests in Wisconsin are about taxpayers versus unions. They're not about taxpayers versus unions. First of all, it's not, you know, the unions are taxpayers. You know, they're people. But in addition, it's really about who's going to be running the country. The 14 state senators who have left Wisconsin to go to Illinois are heroes. Why? Because they are blocking a conservative takeover of the country. They're doing what Abraham Lincoln did way back in the Illinois legislature. When he saw that a disastrous bill was about to be put forth and that he couldn't stop it by being there, the only way he could stop it was by keeping a quorum from being formed, he jumped out a window so that the vote could not be taken. This is, you know, he did this in the service of the people of Illinois. And those 14 legislators, who I think should be called Lincoln legislators, to honor them, are, you know, doing a major public service for the people of America. But that's not how it's reported. What's happening is very simple. You have a view of public discourse that is controlled largely by a conservative system of communication. And they repeat language over and over. And the remarkable thing is that liberals and Democrats take the same language and they'll argue against it. But when they do it, it's like saying, don't think of an elephant, which makes people think of elephants. You know, if you say, no, there isn't a budget crisis, that activates the idea of budget crisis. You know, if you say, rather, there's plenty of money in Wisconsin, there's plenty of money in America, where is it? Okay. Then there's an economic truth, which is that the top 1% of Americans have more financial assets than the bottom 95. We have a huge financial discrepancy in this country, and it got there because of government deregulation, because of the effect of communication systems on elected officials. And the reason that happened is that conservatives do understand the importance of marketing their ideas and getting their ideas across, and they created a communication system to do so. And liberals who think falsely about how people actually think and how language works have not created such a system, and so their ideas are not getting across. This has been going on for the last 40 years, and it's hard to overcome. That is why we're facing the crisis we're facing.
I appreciate very much you taking your time. As I told my audience, you're on a very busy schedule, and we would not keep you. And you've given us, in this 27 minutes uninterrupted discussion, you have given us an extremely important insight that we appreciate. Thank you very much, Professor George Lakoff, author of The Political Mind, Why You Can't Understand 21st Century American Politics with an 18th Century Brain. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a break for a moment, and that was a continuation of our conversation with Remarkable Minds. Coming back, I'm going to talk with Peter Bull, award-winning independent documentary filmmaker, television producer. He created a lot of program specials for PBS and Discovery and CNBC. And he was also one of the lead investigators into why there was not democracy in Haiti and what America was doing to keep democracy out of Haiti, and the money-driven pursuit of the pharmaceutical industry and on front lines, hot topics, and also the government's inability to address important environmental issues. This is a conversation you won't want to miss in a moment.
Got today. be hard for me, baby, to feel my life all over. But baby, you got the love that I really need. Cause if you leave me this way, baby, you know what? I may not live to see a brand new day.
Taking on the coal industry as the topic and its clean coal propaganda. My guest is Peter Bull. I gave a mention at the beginning. I'll repeat what I said. He is an award-winning independent documentary filmmaker, television producer, and writer credited with many specials on PBS, ABC, CNBC, and Discovery. And he is also the author of several important investigative films, including his work on Frontline's Hot Topics. His most recent documentary, produced by the Center for Investigative Reporting, is Dirty Business, Clean Coal and the Battle for Our Energy Future, which has received an APPY Award. Nice to have you with us today, Peter.
Great to be here, Gary.
Peter, I was concerned when candidate Obama and before candidate Obama, junior Senator Obama in Washington, and before that, legislative Obama in the politics of Chicago in Illinois was talking about clean coal. In fact, he had a lot of articles. If you go up and Google it, you'll see how many times he was sponsoring clean coal, movement to nuclear as our clean energy, and gas as a clean burning fuel. So he was aligned with coal, nuclear, and gas, but not with solar, wind, or geothermal or other natural forms. And in fact, when I took a look recently at how much money has been given by this administration to many industries, just the nuclear industry alone, it is just staggering. It is over $27 billion in guarantees. And they're still not backing off the idea of clean coal. Now, I come from West Virginia. Now, I lived in Wheeling, West Virginia, Weirton, West Virginia, where you have Weirton Steel, and up there you got Pittsburgh Steel and Wheeling. And I have a lot of friends and family who have lived in Appalachia. And you drive down through Appalachia now, you're going to see different Appalachia than what many people might assume, all because of coal. Could you take us through a history of this? And also then give us your opinion on the idea that we can develop or should develop clean coal.
Well, yes, and it, as you started out with the president, it is perplexing, except for the fact that one has to recognize that Obama comes from a coal state of Illinois. And one has to wonder how much his stance on these issues is politics and how much is what he really believes, especially if you look at his, you know, the staff of his administration in the Energy Department. He's got around him some of the best minds that are dealing with global warming and future energy, and yet you're absolutely right in your litany of what the Obama administration has supported so far in terms of maintaining support for the fossil fuel industry and promoting and not promoting enough renewables. On the other hand, his administration has, with the stimulus package, put much more money into renewable energy than any previous administration except for Jimmy Carter's. But the power of the fossil fuel industry is pretty staggering, and it's a political power because we call it big coal, but in fact the coal industry isn't really that big, but it does exercise a disproportionate political clout, especially in coal states like your home state of West Virginia. In fact, the whole economy of West Virginia is so dependent on coal that its tax system is really based on the way they tax the revenues from coal. So it's pretty hard to see how West Virginia could make a big shift away from its over-reliance on coal towards renewables without doing a massive legislative kind of overhaul. But, you know, to go back, as you say, coal has been a crucial source of energy. It is single-handedly the most important energy source in getting us into and through the Industrial Revolution before the exploitation of oil. Coal still provides nearly 50% of our electricity today. Each American consumes the equivalent of about 20 pounds of coal per day. It's hard to imagine, and I think many Americans are really unaware of that. They think, all the coal mining goes on in Appalachia, where you're from. In fact, the bulk of our coal now comes from vast open pit mines in the Powder River Basin of Wyoming and Montana. There's this feeling that, you know, coal jobs are crucial to our economy, especially, which is pretty true in West Virginia, but the number of coal jobs has been decreasing dramatically over the years. One thinks of this as just a purely jobs issue. The amount of coal mined in this country has doubled since 1973, while the total number of coal mining jobs has been cut in half. And that's largely because of the new massive industrial-scale mining techniques like the notorious mountaintop removal mining, where they lay off a ton of miners who were doing these underground mines and put a couple of guys on one of these vast machines that does these massive drag lines scraping off the top of the mountain, dumping it into the valleys where they plug up the natural spring streams that provide the drinking water. And, it's just a very wasteful process. And so coal has brought us this far, but it is the dirtiest fuel around. From the mining process, as I was just talking about with mountaintop removal, the environmental devastation there, then you have the burning of coal releases all sorts of toxic metals, mercury, nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide lead to ozone, particulates, which cause 24,000 premature deaths per year, has a massive cost for just the air pollution. And there's the storage of the coal waste, the coal ash. That's the stuff that, caused a huge, awful flood in Kingston, Tennessee last year. Mining disasters, which we've had. The Chileans are experiencing that right now. It's occupational safety problems. And then the global warming problem. Coal accounts for 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions in this country. So it's almost 50% of our electricity. It's the largest single source of CO2 emissions. It's carbon dioxide. In China, it's 80% of their energy and something like 70% of their carbon dioxide emissions. And China now has eclipsed the U.S. as being the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases worldwide. But still, Americans, each American consumes about three times as much carbon dioxide as energy that emits carbon dioxide as each Chinese citizen. So, they're still coming they are bringing millions and millions of people out of poverty and the 19th century, really, in their quest for modernization. So they're going through the Industrial Revolution right now that we've already been through. So it's, you know, on one level, it's a bit hard for us to say, you know, China, you should stop burning all this coal. You know, we are the ones that put up that all the CO2 in the atmosphere that is causing such trouble now. So, I know, Gary, that's sort of a wandering answer to your
question. It's a good overview. Your documentary draws a comparison between walking through all the steps, beginning with mining coal to actual energy production, is similar to visiting a slaughterhouse. So I'd first ask you to take us on this tour to show us just how environmentally devastating the coal industry actually is.
Yeah, it's at its most devastating in the mining process. It's the mountaintop removal that it's the most devastating. The underground mining is not nearly, doesn't have as nearly as much of an impact on the environment, but it's by no means clean. I mean, there is this thing called acid mine drainage. And when water gets in these mines, it leaches out these toxic metals that have been safely, you know, buried under millennia of sediment. And when exposed to the open rain, that stuff, very toxic stuff, leaches into the water supply. Then there's all the storage problems of the ash, coal ash and stuff, that it's the same whatever kind of mining you do. So the mining process itself is very, very destructive. In fact, it releases a lot of carbon dioxide just carving up the earth. Then there's the health effects of the burning of it, and then there's the problem what to do with the residual ash, the waste. And so at each stage in the process, there are environmental problems. Now, we have the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is there to regulate this industry, supposedly. For the last 8 years, during the Bush administration, the EPA was basically hogtied. They did very little. And they allowed permits for a lot of this mountaintop removal, which many people have argued is in many ways a violation of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, the Clean Water Act in particular, because of the way the mining process dumps the residual overburden, they call it, into the surrounding valleys and covering up all these water supplies. But the Bush administration and under the EPA under the Bush administration basically looked the other way, and a couple of very conservative judges had some very questionable rulings. But the political process down in West Virginia is such that, you know, we had the famous pictures of Don Blankenship, the notorious CEO of Massey Energy, which owned the mine that had the latest disaster. He was photographed on the Riviera partying with the judge on the state Supreme Court who was actually hearing cases against Massey. So there is a lot of corruption in the coal industry and the political system. So that also makes legislation and makes hogties regulators. Now under Lisa Jackson, the EPA has already taken very forceful steps, although there was some questionable permitting of additional mountaintop removals right after the Obamas came in. But now they are really standing firm, and it's pretty clear now, because of the Senate's failure to pass any kind of energy or climate legislation so far, and with the midterms coming up and the last 2 years of Obama's first you know, term, you know, it's very unlikely we're going to get a carbon legislation out of Congress. And that's a problem, because many people would argue that you can't encourage industry to come up with solutions to creating greenhouse gases unless you put a price on carbon dioxide as a pollutant. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has backed up the Environmental Protection Agency, which has had an endangerment finding. They have found that the EPA has issued a finding saying that carbon dioxide is a pollutant and endangers the human community. So under that, the EPA can regulate carbon dioxide emissions, and Lisa Jackson has said very forcefully she will do so. It is now up to them to try to rein in the industry. And so what is at stake? Are the idea of new coal plants going up? What kind of coal plants will be built? How are we going to meet our energy needs? And that's really the question that really faces us all now in the wake of the Senate's failure to take any action.
Okay, two last questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched so many ads on CNN sponsored by the coal industry, which seems to be losing the argument that clean coal is only one part of the process, but that the huge tracts of land that you referred to, out west, for example, will still be laid waste by mining and mountains removed in the east, and the use of many toxic chemicals and the release of toxic particulate matter into the atmosphere and slurry pits. And all this represents an environmental devastating impact that just doesn't seem to bother too many people. So the bottom line is, you have CNN and others that do not do the original investigative reporting, which they're fully capable of doing, that would then challenge them. Why aren't the major networks not out there with major stories showing that these are really corrupting practices and are not going to bring us to a place where we need to be as a society, and especially in caring for our environment?
Well, that's an excellent question, Gary, and it really begs a whole show on what's happened to our mainstream media. But I will, first of all, I think we should, I failed earlier to address what you meant when you said clean coal, which is a big factor in my film. First of all, there is no such thing as clean coal. What is referred to, what one has to assume they're referring to when anyone says clean coal, is this technology called carbon capture and sequestration. And it's very technical, but in a nutshell it means let's put a filter on the coal plant and filter out the carbon dioxide before it goes out into the air, into the atmosphere. And there are many different kinds of techniques for absorbing or capturing that carbon. And then the idea would be to bury that carbon dioxide in deep geological sediments. And, you know, carbon dioxide is a gas. But when you compress it, when you highly compress it, it goes into a supercritical liquid state, and you can indeed pump it down, you know, like 1 or 2 miles deep. And they have been doing that, you know, since the 40s or 50s in Texas, you know, because they use the CO2, they inject it into old oil wells. And, you know, when you drill full oil, there's usually about 30% of the oil you can't get out. They use the CO2 to, it mixes with the oil, makes it less viscous, and they can pump it out. So they know that the geologists and the engineers know the technology of burying CO2 very deep. And they know that if you put it in an absorbent layer, a sandstone-like porous layer of rock, and then you have a cap rock on top of it, that will prevent it from leaching upwards, it will stay there. In fact, it will bond chemically with the stone and form a kind of a limestone and stay down there. Now, the question is, so yes, I do believe that carbon capture and sequestration can technically work if it's done properly in the right geological area. But we have some 8,000 coal plants worldwide, and if we are going to have any effect on global warming, you're going to have to do that to every single coal plant in the world. And many of them aren't anywhere near this kind of geology, so you'd have to put it in pipes, and this is a very corrosive material, CO2, and pump it hundreds of miles away. We are right now, we're pumping CO2 from northern Nebraska up to Saskatchewan, and I did some filming up there. And they're pumping it into old wells and to get the oil. It's called enhanced oil recovery. And then they're doing a prototype experiment up there where they're also sequestering it, trying to keep it down there, seeing how well it stays down there. And very early into my reporting, I found a ranch family who was living adjacent to this area. And they lived in the town called Goodwater, because that's what they named it. Water was so pure when the railroads were coming through. And their wells were always crystal clear water, and now they've had to abandon their ranch because something has been getting into their water supply. And it looks like the kind of problems we can expect with carbon capture and sequestration, which is not unlike hydraulic fracturing, you know, buried, like what you hear about the natural gas. Burying the stuff underground can be done, but it has to be done really carefully and well, and we can't always trust industry to do that. So in a nutshell, that's what clean coal is about. But the problem there is when you capture CO2 from a coal plant, you decrease the plant's efficiency by up to 30%. And so what it will mean is you'll actually have to burn 30% more coal to get the same energy from that clean coal plant. So in other words, clean coal technology means mining more coal, and it means an infrastructure of piping and compression and tankers and all the stuff we associate with the petrochemical industry. It's going to require an infrastructure that's, by some estimates, 10 times as large to do that to all the coal plants. So one has to ask, how expensive is this clean coal going to be? And we're already, the Obama, you know, the stimulus bill, actually the Waxman-Markey bill that didn't pass but passed in the House, put $60 billion up for clean coal. We are putting billions of money into a technology that has not been proved commercially feasible, and they, in the industry itself, admits won't be ready for 10 or 15 years. So, yeah, it's a lot, raises a lot of questions.
Peter Boyle, I thank you very much for coming on, and we look forward to watching what happens, and hopefully people will take the chance to read the work you do. You can go to the website dirtybusinessthefilm.com, or you can watch the film Dirty Business, Clean Coal, and Our Battle for Our Energy Future. And I'm sure they can get the same information where to get the film on the website. All the best to you in all your efforts, Peter.
Thanks very much, Gary.
Have a nice day, everyone.